I would like to thank Professor Vidal and Sensei Lee and Lukasz for organizing this in the very last minute. I had a bit of a problem with the spam filter, which caused all of this, so thanks to you all for showing up on such a short notice. I'd like to first thank my agencies for the money. So FQRNT from Quebec, Walter Sumner Foundation, NSERC, U of T, and MIT, which funded some of the research. And so as he mentioned, I'll talk about the interplay between interactions and spin-orbit coupling and how these things give rise to phases like Val fermions and helical spin liquids. And this is roughly the roadmap. So I'm going to start by introducing TIs. So, I mean, I've probably heard this often, but I'm just going to talk about the non-interacting phase, and eventually we're going to put interactions in that. And also, we're going to mention the particle error dates, which are the connection to the real world for this material. Now, the talk itself is organized in main two parts. So the first part will be about the topological and magnetic phases in these particle error dates. And I'll talk about the effective microscopic Hamiltonian we have come up with, the mean field and strong coupling results, as well as some clustered MFT work that we're doing with collaborators. And that's more on the UV part, and we're going to flow to the IR with some quantum field theory work on a novel spin liquid phase, which is called the topological Mott insulator. I'll introduce the slave rotors, which are the tool we're going to use, talk about the mean field state as presented by Pesson balance, then discuss in detail what the gauge fluctuations do to that mean field state, and eventually talk about interesting possibilities such as non-quantized magnetoelectric effect, as well as baryonic excitations in this liquid. So this is, you know, the must slide on TIs. There's only one, so be patient. So, I mean, I can ask this following question: how many different band insulators we have in 3D which preserve time reversal symmetry? And surprisingly, that question was only answered a few years ago. And this was answered by Fouquet and Melle, Moore Balance, and Roy. And interestingly enough, experiments were found where this material was observed by See and company at Princeton. So what was found is that you have these Z2 classification of phases. So you have in 3D, which will be the focus of my talk, you have four indices, each of which can be zero or one. And if they're all zero, it's a trivial insulator which can be connected to an atomic insulator where the electrons only sit on the atoms and do nothing special. If one of the indices varies from zero, then you get a non-trivial phase. I'm going to focus on the nu zero equal one, which corresponds to the strong topological insulator phase. And this is interesting because it has robust surface states. So as long as the disorder is not magnetic, you cannot kill these states as long as you don't close the ball gap. So, and this was also observed in experiments. And the surface states, you can think about the surface states in these strong TIs as being an odd number of Dirac cones. So that's a simple case where you have a single Dirac cone. And this diagram also shows the helicity of the surface states. So there's a momentum spin locking. And this will also give rise to this helical part in the spin liquid I'm going to talk about. And now, the question that a lot of people are asking these days is, what happens as you put interactions in these phases? You know, can you get a zoo of interesting many body states as you get in the fractional Hall effect, as opposed to the integer one? So there's two sort of possibilities that people expect, is that first, if interactions are not too strong, you get qualitatively the same behavior as in a TI. Just have dressed quasiparticles, which behave in the TI manner, and you have the same observables. The other part, which is more interesting, is when you get states which are not connected to a TBI. And these usually involve fractionalization of sorts. And this will be the focus on the second part, whereas this is mostly the focus on the first part. And it would be cool to find some experimental candidates which realize some of these fractionalized or interacting TIs. And that's why the error dates are a nice playground, which I'm going to introduce now, actually. So the motivation to study these compounds in particular is that they have comparable spin-orbit coupling and interactions. And this sets up a nice interplay between these two effects and can give rise to potentially new phases. And these guys are made out of A, iridium, and O, oxygen, where A is a yttrium or a lanthanide. Both the A and iridium lie on this particle lattice of corner-sharing tetrahedra. And the key physics we'll focus on today is from the iridium, so the compounds for which the A-site is non-magnetic. I should mention that Sungbin Lee will talk about the iridates tomorrow also, and they have a new mean field theory picture that covers a lot of phases, so you know, this sort of nicely presents her work or the background, so don't miss that tomorrow. In terms of experiments, I'm going to highlight only two things. So the first thing is that people observe different metal insulator transitions in these compounds, both as you tune chemical pressure or hydrostatic pressure. So chemical pressure would correspond to changing the A-site by going across the lanthanide family. And the other thing is that there are hints that these systems are ordered magnetically at low temperatures. So it's not clear that they are, but recent USR data find well-defined precession frequency for the muons. And this suggests that you have some commensurate long-range order. But if there is order, we don't know of how it looks like, the nature of the order. So this is ongoing research. And that's why our work is trying to see what kind of orders you can really get in these compounds. On the theory side, there's very nice work by Pesson and Balance in which they proposed the topological insulating phase as well as a novel spin liquid to be found in the phase diagram for these iridates. This I'll talk more about in the second part of the talk. For the first part, there's theoretical work which is more relevant. So this is the ab initio work by Wan, Ari Turner, Savrasov, and Ashwin Vishwanath. So they looked specifically, I think, at the yttrium-based iridate, and that's a phase diagram they find, and like, let's just focus on the zero B field part. And the reason why this got a lot of attention is because they found this new phase, which we call the topological vial semi-metal. In this case, it's Dirac in that figure, but we'll use the word vial. So this phase has vial fermions as excitations in the lower energy limit. And so our motivation going to this project was, so there are all these different proposals for interesting phases. And this work in particular, you know, is the FT work, so it's not very clear to see what gives rise to what, because you have, you know, all the orbitals, you have the A-site also, so it's not clear what gives rise, for example, to this vial phase. And obviously we cannot check all the different magnetic orders because, you know, we have to run this simulation, it's quite heavy, so we wanted to have a lighter weight model that covers all of these interesting phases. And it turns out that sort of we came up with something quite simple which captures a lot of the phases, actually more than we thought originally. So this is what I'm going to introduce next. It's pretty simple. So we focus on the iridium electrons. So they're in the D state. So we have 10 levels. Each iridium is coordinated by 8 oxygens, and this splits these levels into EG and T2G. These guys are not occupied and are believed to be quite far from the Fermi level, so we just don't take them into account. Further, iridium is a large atom, so it has big enough spin-orbit coupling. And this spin-orbit coupling will further split these 6 levels into 2 groups, J1/2 and J3/2. We have 5 electrons. We fill the lower manifold. The upper manifold is half-filled. If spin-orbit coupling is large enough, these 2 sets of levels are well-separated. This is full, so you would expect the physics to come only from the J1/2 manifold. And this is what we'll focus on, and we'll see what physics comes out of that. So effectively, we have a pseudo-spin 1/2 model. And then let's just add hopping to this atomic picture. There's 2 paths you can hop, actually. So between 2 iridiums, there's an oxygen, and you can hop on the oxygen and back on the other iridium. And this was introduced first by Pesson Balance. And the one we introduced, which was not appreciated before, is this direct hopping between iridiums. So the electrons are in a 5D configuration, so it's quite large, and there's, you know, quite a bit of overlap between these 2 atoms, so you don't expect these things to be small. And there's 2 numbers, T sigma and T pi, just coming from the different, you know, chemical bonding, if you want, sigma and pi. So the Hamiltonian we're going to deal with is a simple Hamiltonian where you have this kinetic part with oxygen hopping and direct hopping, and you have the Hubbard repulsion on the iridium side. So a single band Hubbard model.
Do you know why they didn't include those?
Well, for simplicity, they found, I guess, enough interesting phases without these things. And I mean, since they were interested in topological phases, their phases are not destroyed if you add these hoppings. You know, they remain stable for some range. So Yeah, I mean, I'll show how their phase diagram is modified when you add these things. But they do mention in the paper that these things are there, but we just don't include them. And also, so in their case, if you don't include these direct hoppings, it's sort of harder to tune across the phase diagram of the iridates among different compounds. At no interaction, you always get this TI state for large enough spin-orbit coupling. Whereas, you know, in the experiments, you find these metallic states and things like that. So this we're going to use as a tuning parameter across the family. So that's the U equals zero phase diagram. So the Pesson balance point is here, the TI at the origin. So I'll measure everything in terms of the oxygen hopping. So that's set equal to one. And as I said, this is a topological phase. So it's not going to be destroyed if you add moderate direct hopping. There's a huge slab, actually. But eventually, you metallize the system, and then you go back into a TI state. And these two TIs have the same indices. So they can be connected by either like this, or there's some other direction in phase space, which will connect them by definition. Oh, and I should mention that, so instead of looking at what happens in interactions when you add interactions to this phase diagram, we're going to consider only this cut. And this cut is motivated by two things. First, we expect to be a relation between these two hopping parameters, T sigma and T pi, which is opposite sign and roughly of this ratio, 2/3. And also, this cut goes through all the phases in this phase diagram, so it's representative. So we're going to just focus on this cut and use T sigma as a tuning parameter. So in the next phase diagram, which is sort of the main result, that's the mean field analysis of this Hubbert model. T sigma is on this axis, and the Hubbert scale is here. So at low U, you have the phases I just described, the TI, the metal, and the TI, and eventually you break transversal symmetry, you magnetize. So all the shaded regions are magnetic, and we find two types of orders. So in the middle, we find this all-in, all-out configuration, which was discussed before by Wan and company. And you have all the moments pointing either towards the center or away from the tetrahedron, middle of the tetrahedron. And in these regions, there's the same ordering, and you find the cousin states of the all-in, all-out, actually. So if you take this state and you do local 90-degree rotations, you get this state. So for example, if you take the two higher spins and you sort of rotate them like this, you get the two upper spins. And the two lower spins, if you rotate them by 90 degrees upwards, you get the lower configuration. So, and these are chiral because if you take a triple product of the spins along any triangle, you get the same number, just as for this configuration. So, I mean, they are sort of cousin states. Yes.
PMI phase? It's not present here.
Yeah, so this is only, so the TMI phase is a spin-liquid phase, so it does not break any time reversal. And this is not captured by Hartree-Fock analysis. You need to do like a sort of slave particle mean field theory, which I'll talk about in a second part. And that's one thing we nice sort of fit in both phases and there's like compare the energies of the spin liquids and the magnetic phases. And that has not been done yet. It's not such an easy task, but yeah. So that you know the spin liquid phase could potentially fit somewhere at the boundary of the Mott transition. Mott transition, it's a mean field transition, so. But so all these guys are insulating except near the boundary where we find this topological vial semimetal. So like in these slivers. Yeah, they're very small slivers, but it's still there and they're present in different orders, actually. So we look at different orders and we sort of always found this vial semimetal to be present. So this is sort of suggestive that it's quite robust, at least in this configuration. So let me just talk about this vial phase a bit. So this phase is a semimetallic phase, which has a Fermi surface consisting of points. And these points we call vial points. And the Hamiltonian near one such vial point, which we set to be q equals zero, looks like this. So q dot sigma, where q is a three vector. And we chose the simplest point, so isotropic and no tilting, because this does not sort of modify the physics I'm going to talk about. And if you take any cut along that point, you get a Dirac cone. So on your momentum space plane cutting that point, you get a cone like this. And these fermions are two-component, just like vials. But the thing is that sigma is not the spin of the fermion. It's just the two bands crossing at that point. And it turns out you can define a chirality for these things, just as for neutrinos, massless neutrinos. And this is plus minus one corresponding to this plus minus here. Another point is that you cannot gap these things out, at least not at this non-interacting level. Actually, interactions are not that efficient also at gapping them out. This is, yeah. So in this case, it's QX, QI, QZ, and you use all the sigma matrices. So there's no local perturbation that can modify, that can gap this out. Because any Hermitian perturbation will have the sigma matrices, and this will just shift where the vial point is in the Bruin zone. No, actually, there's always pairs of opposite chirality. So yeah, it's always even number. And it's also topological. The word topological is overloaded, but in this case, I think it's justified because you can see these things as monopoles of the Berry flux. So they are indeed robust features in a band structure, even though they're accidental crossings. So it's quite a surprise. And so to remove these guys, I mean, there's a way. They're not that robust, because otherwise we would have seen them before. The thing is that you have two vials of opposite chirality meeting somewhere, just like you need to mix left and right-hand neutrinos to make a Dirac for number of mass. So that's how you gap this phase out. So let me go over again the main results. So we did find different MITs, so both at low interactions, so from here to here, for example, and as you turn interaction, so from the metal to this magnetic insulator, we found different orders, so the all-in, all-out, and cousins. And the vial phase was found in all these orders. It's actually a different vial phase, depending on the order. So in the all-in, all-out, this comes out of a second-order transition from a semi-metallic phase. So this metal is really a semi-metal, so it's a quadratic band touching. And as you magnetize, you split this band touching into a pair of, or like actually it's eight vial nodes. And this sort of asks the question more generally, generically, in what cases do you make Dirac or vial nodes out of a quadratic band touching? What are the conditions to get that? That's something we're thinking about now. And in these vial phases, out of the TI, it's a first order transition. And they also have eight vial points, actually. So one interesting thing about these states is that they have surface states. So the vial phase has chiral surface states. So this is a finite geometry spectrum for one of the vial phases. And this is the 2D Bruin zone of the surface. And the cool thing is that the surface states take the form of Fermi arcs, so open Fermi arcs, not a closed Fermi arc forming a Fermi surface of sorts. And the red and blue points correspond to projections of the vial points on the surface Bruin zone. And the red and blue colors are the opposite chirality. So for example, if you look at this, these two Fermi arcs, the upper Fermi arc lies on the top surface, and the lower Fermi arc would lie on the lower Fermi surface, for example. That's how we can sort of break a Fermi surface into open Fermi arcs in this finite geometry. So that's a robust feature of this phase. Now we did some checks beyond the mean field. So first of all, we looked at large Hubbard interactions. So for U much greater than all the hoppings in a problem. And in that case, you get a spin model, or a pseudo-spin model, I should say. And since a Hamiltonian is not very symmetric, you have all possible interactions. So the Heisenberg term, but you also have the Jelushinsky-Maria term and the spin anisotropy term. Then we compared this with Monte Carlo results for the nearest neighbor Heisenberg model in the particle lattice, so the model which includes only these two first terms. Actually, this turns out to be not terribly important. And what these guys found for this model, which is what we get, is that the order you get depends on what type of DM interaction you get. And the DM interaction is very simple in the particle order dates. There's only two possibilities, and I show here one. So the blue arrows correspond to the D vectors, the Z vector. And that's called indirect. And the direct one is you just take all the arrows and change them direction, so opposite sign. So what they find is that if you have a direct DM interaction, you always get all in, all out. If it's indirect, you get this continuous manifold of degenerate states. So it's interesting that you have this very simple difference. It's just a different sign, and you get a very different ground state or set of ground states. So then we're like, okay, we're going to look at what we get in terms of VM interactions and compare with what they get, earthquake. So here I'm plotting one component of the VM vector. And this is the T sigma we use to tune our phase diagram. So what we find is that we get indirect, direct, and indirect again. And these two red dots correspond to phase transitions we had. So this is at low U, that's a TI, that's a metal, and that's a TI. And remember, out of the metal, at large U, we found that we get the all-in, all-out order, which is in the direct DM interaction, and that corresponds to the Monte Carlo simulations. And for the indirect ones, we found these three cousin states, and they're actually included in their continuous set of degenerate configurations. So this sort of sheds insight on what type of ordering you get at lower U. So there's a connection between the large U limit, the spin model, and the lower U Hartree-Fock ordering. And then we got a bit more serious about the actual quantum fluctuations. So this was mean field, so no fluctuations really. So we asked collaborators, so Arago and her supervisor at the University of Seoul, to do some DMFT work on this Hamiltonian. And actually have to cluster DMFT because the unit cell has four sites. So this sort of makes it a bit heavy, but they did it. So the cluster to use is a one unit cell, which is a tetrahedron. And they used eight sites as their effective bath. And to solve the cluster, so you solve the cluster exactly, and they use ED, and then you sort of match with the effective bath, and you reiterate until you converge. And at the end, you get some sort of Green's function, or self-energy for your fermions. And that's the spectral function for the fermions in one phase. And the black lines are the Hartree-Fock results. So actually, there's a nice correspondence. It's not too far away from the mean field results. And let me summarize the preliminary results they get. So first, they find the same configurations for the spins as we do. And in both cases, we didn't constrain our search. So it's a nice check. They also find that the TI and vowel phases are stable to moderate interactions. So the vowel crossing, for example, remains sharp for at least some range of interactions. And they did further study by looking at actual surface states in real space DMFT. So you take layers of your compound and you solve them consistently. Look at the surface states. And they found that the surface states also remain sharp for some range of the interactions. And that's like one of the first studies of correlations on these 3D vial phase and TIs. It's interesting work that should come out pretty soon. Now I'm going to shift gears. I'm going to not shift gears. Yeah, let's go back to this.
So I thought that the MFT could only give you symmetry recompenses.
Right. Then.
Symmetry recompenses. So there is some topological character of phases you are describing that will be missed by the MFT.
Well, so in this case, the topological character of the TI and valve phase comes about from the surface states. And that's something that you can actually examine within the MFT.
Okay, so there is no problem.
There's no problem. It's harder to find spin liquids with the MFT.
Right.
But surface states is something that you can do, actually. Look at layers of your material and actually solve the real space slab made of, 10 layers, say. And look at how states live on a top layer. And these are, So you can see how the surface states evolve as you tune interactions. And they see that indeed they remain sharp for some range. Eventually, the single particle breaks down and you have a well-defined moth phase. And then there's no TI at that point. So this is all sort of more conventional. And now we're going to shift gears to the field theory part of the talk. And I'm going to talk about this sort of spin liquid, which is called a topological moth insulator, and how this thing is helical. So in the previous part, I just mentioned the phase diagram and had a part that looked like this, where you had a TI, and eventually, when you increase the Hubbard U, you magnetize the sample, and you destroy the TI, because TI has to have time reversal symmetry. So we have this transition between a TI and a conventional phase. And the question is, can you have, as someone asked earlier, where does the spin liquid fit in? Can you have some intervening phase before you magnetize? And the answer is that yes, possibly. And why do we expect a spin liquid to appear here? Is because near the Mach transition, all the charge fluctuations can be effective at disrupting the ordering. So it's not uncommon to find materials or lattices that have a narrow window of spin liquid near the Mach transition. And this is like a frustrated lattice. It's a triangular based lattice, this sparkler thing. So it might be that you have a spin liquid. And eventually you get a magnetic phase at large U. And this transition is sort of best described, or most simply, using the Slate-Rotor formulation of the Hubbard model. So, and this formulation was proposed by Serge Flourens and Antoine Georges. And the field theory of it was made by Sensik Lee and Patrick Lee at MIT. And this approach is valid for weak U and intermediate U near the Mach transition. It actually connects to the U equals zero states. So that's an advantage of that method, which other methods, which are based on, like the TJ model, for example, don't connect to the small U limit. It's a parton construction where you take your electron operator C and you break it up into two particles, F. Sigma is a spin-on. It carries the spin of the fermion, the electron. It's a fermion. And e to the I theta, or minus I theta, is a rotor variable, and this carries the charge degree of freedom of the original electron. Theta is an angle variable going from 0 to 2 pi. So we have enlarged the Hilbert space, and we need to constrain to look at physical states. And this is a constraint that one needs to impose to recover the original Hubbard model exactly. So L is the angular momentum conjugate to this theta variable, and this counts how many rotors you have on each side. And what this constraint says is that you have the number of rotors has to be equal to the number of spin-ons on each side, modulo this minus one shift. And this gives rise to one component of an emergent gauge field in the field theory formulation, the time-like component. The other components come from fluctuations of fermionic bilinears as you look at fluctuations beyond a mean field or saddle point state. So in the end, you're left with a full U1 abelian gauge field. And the theory, you have your spin-ons, the rotors, and they interact via this gauge field. Actually, strongly by construction. So what Pessen-Balanz did in their Nature Physics paper is that they looked at the phase diagram of this mean field theory within the slave rotor formulation for the iridates, actually. And so lambda is a spin-orbit coupling. So let's consider large lambda, which is most interesting here. They find a TI or TBI phase at low interactions. Eventually, as you have very large interactions, you get some magnetic ordering, which they don't find, they just expect it to be there. But in between, they identify this spin liquid phase, which they call the TMI, and that stands for the topological mod insulator. And this phase has all the charge being gapped. So the rotors, which carry the charge, are fully gapped or massive. However, the spin-ons acquire the non-trivial band topology of the TI state at the mean field level. So this means that the spin-ons are in a TI state, so they're gapped in a bulk, but they have protected surface modes by time reversal symmetry. So you have these gapless spin-on surface states, and these guys are helical. And one big difference with a regular TI is that these spin-on states are not free, but they're strongly coupled to gauge fluctuations, this emergent gauge field. And we'll see how this affects the actual mean field results. So this is work that we've done on this analysis of quantum field fluctuations around this mean field state. So the low energy theory, just to resume again, it's the you have Dirac fermions at finite chemical potential, and these form a helical liquid of spin-ons. And then you have this 3D emergent gauge boson. So the spin-ons are these black dots here. The cone is there to show the helical nature. And the wiggly lines are the gauge bosons, which interact, which couple these spin-ons together. So the Hamiltonian density would have a term like this, where so F here is a surface spin-ons, because the bulk spins are gapped, so we don't really care too much about them. So F is a surface spin-on, and this is minimally coupled to this emergent gauge field, which we evaluate on the surface, which we take to be z equals zero. And this gauge charge is order one. So to treat the gauge field, we used Dirichlet boundary conditions. The reason we didn't impose von Neumann conditions is because we didn't want to set the gauge field to be zero on the surface, otherwise there's no coupling between the spin-ons and the gauge bosons. And we do expect to have some coupling. For example, if you write down a lattice gauge theory for the system, and the gauge field enters by modifying the phase of the hopping of the spin-ons, and you expect this to survive in the surface and the layers just beneath it. And we also believe that this sort of captures the main essence of the problem. So the gauge boson essentially gets these standing waves in the bulk in the z direction, and you have momentum as a good quantum number in the xy plane. So the gauge charge is order one, so perturbation theory does not seem like a great thing to do, but it's the first thing one can do. And also, I'll argue that it's not necessarily as bad as it looks, at least in this liquid. Because for 2D spin liquids, things are pretty bad. But for this, there's signs that it might be better controlled. So if you look at perturbation theory in this gauge interaction, the first thing we would do is to look at how the spin-ons affect the gauge bosons. And the canonical thing that happens is that you have a gauge boson walking in a sample, and it just decays into a particle hole pair of spin-ons on a surface. And this will damp the gauge boson. This is a sort of canonical damping, omega over q. But there's only in-plane momentum because the spin-on surface states only live in the xy plane. And vf is the Fermi velocity of the surface. And here I should put like a standing wave number on the wiggly line because each mode gets this damping. Then we can look at how this renormalized boson feeds back into the fermion self-energy. So implicit here, there's a summation over all standing waves. So we are including all excitations. And what you get is this marginal looking self-energy. So there's a logarithmic enhancement compared to the dynamical free term, which is I omega. And this is weaker than what you would get in a pure 2D theory of spin-ons coupled to gauge bosons. In that case, you get omega to the 2/3. So that's a much bigger renormalization. Actually, we expected this because we gave the bosons, the gauge bosons, this third dimension to move in, and this usually washes out the fluctuations. So it renders them less efficient. Still, it doesn't kill them totally because you get this log enhancement. So you get this marginal behavior because you have a 3D nature for the gauge bosons. And now we did something beyond perturbation theory. We did a one-loop RG on this problem. And we found that the gauge charge is actually marginally irrelevant. So it flows very slowly to some weakly coupled fixed point, as long as the original starting point is small enough. That's a caveat, is that this RG has no control parameter, really. So we're doing perturbative RG, but there's no truncation, which is natural in the theory. One can introduce a large number of spin-on flavors, so large N limit. But that does not cure everything. As Professor Sunsek-Lee showed, the large N limit for these U1 spin liquids coupled, this Fermi surface coupled to a massless boson, the large N is sort of disrupted because you have these virtual fermions that hop on a Fermi surface. And this sort of kills the naive power counting in 1 over N. So even the 1 over N does not really work for these spin liquids. And we believe that the same holds in this case, even though the gauge boson has this extra dimension to live in.
Let me ask, so for the previous one, when you were comparing, when you identified the term which looked marginal,
yes,
that wasn't so good. So is this a two-dimensional effective theory?
So effectively, the theory, no. I mean, so you have this 2D fermions and a 3D boson. So the spin-ons are gapped in a bulk, but the gauge field lives in a whole sample. The gauge field is, by U1 gauge invariance, is present and massless everywhere. Only the time-like component is screened, but the transverse part of the gauge field is always massless. It's a deconfined phase. No, that's a good question. Actually, we haven't looked at the full 3D case. For some reason, people don't look at the full three case for spin liquids because I guess things are just way better controlled there.
We can talk about that.
Yeah, I can check. Well, I have the slope in my paper. Just
yeah.
So, yeah. So, I mean, yeah, so future work would be sort of to understand how to control this theory better. Since the CLI is doing some progress in understanding these spin liquids in the large end limit via string theory. But it's not an easy task. But imagine we buy this sort of perturbation theory picture. Imagine the renormalizations don't modify this that much, which is not such a bold thing to believe. What kind of signatures do we get for this phase? So what makes it special? So the heat capacity is the first thing you could look at, and we find that it's as you expect in a marginal Fermi liquid, T log T. In a regular 2D Fermi liquid, you get just linear T, so you get this enhancement, you have extra entropy in the state. You can also look at Arkikoi interactions. So you take two magnetic moments and you put them on a surface. And because you have all these, this Fermi surface, the fermions will mediate long-range interactions between these two moments. And this is the effective Hamiltonian you get between these two spins. And it doesn't look like this sort of canonical, simple Heisenberg Hamiltonian because the Fermi surface on the edge is helical. So momentum and spin are locked. And this gives rise to this interesting angle dependence for the Arkikoi interaction. But this was known from the non-interacting picture also. So the gauge interaction does not alter the symmetries of the problem. It actually adds another symmetry, adds the local U1 gauge invariance. So but what's new is the actual dependence and the separation R between the spins. So OK, I should write down a cosine 2kf R, which oscillates, or a sine, depending on which coefficient we're looking at. But I'm just looking at the envelope here. So the envelope, usually with the k as 1 over r squared for a 2D Fermi liquid, but here we get this log suppression. So this interaction decays faster in space. And one of the ways of seeing why this happens is because you know you have these fermions, which are not so sharp anymore. The gauge fluctuations smear the particles, and this gives rise to sort of softer singularities in any diagram. So this diagram, which is used to compute the Arkikoi interactions, is the correlation functions at 2kf. Or KF as a Fermi vector for the surface states. So you have these smeared fermions which give rise to shorter range interactions. Things are not as sharp. So let me summarize these things and also lead on to my next topic. So if we compare the TMI with a regular TI, capacity in our case, we get a T log T, which is log larger than the TI case for surface states. RKKY are suppressed by this log. There's no charge transport in the system. For a TMI, it's totally charge gapped. Whereas for a TI, you get transport on the surface, as people have measured in the lab. Thermal transport is present in both cases. You have gapless degrees of freedom. They carry entropy. In this case, it was probably different from this case because you have strong interacting theory. So we haven't computed these things exactly, but we do expect differences. So the third point, the fourth point, fifth point, I cannot count, is the most interesting one maybe, is the magnetoelectric effect. So in a TI, if you apply, so if you gap out the surface states and you apply an E field, you can magnetize a sample. Or if you apply a B field, you can polarize a sample. And that's called the magnetoelectric effect. And the constant of proportionality for the response field is universal. It depends only on E and H. And this comes from an axion term in Lagrangian, E dot B, and the axion angle is pi for a TI. That's actually one defining property of a TI, having this axionic response. And the question is, can we get some real magnetoelectric effect in this TMI phase? So this is sort of work in progress, actually work that we talked about with Brian Swingle while I was at MIT this summer. So as I said, in a TBI, if you gap out the surface states by coating a thin magnetic film, you can get this topological magnetoelectric response, which gives you a B field out of an E field, or vice versa. And in a TMI, since the fermions, the spinons, acquire the band structure of a TI, you also expect to get an axion term, an effective action for the gauge field. But this time, for the emergent gauge field, so the lowercase corresponds to the emergent gauge field. So you get this E dot B term, and theta is also pi. And now, can this sort of lead to a real E dot B response for the ENM field? And so the way of looking at this is that the rotors carry both ENM charge and emergent charge. And if you integrate them out, you can do that, they're massive, you get an effective theory in terms of the two gauge fields, the ENM field, which is the capital letter, and the lowercase is the emergent one. So you get this coupled gauge theory, and there's gauge mixing via this term. Alpha comes from integrating on the rotors. So this depends, this alpha depends on the gap in your TI state. And then sort of you can do a back of the envelope Gedanken where you stick in a magnetic monopole of the ENM field, and you look at what kind of charge can you bind to that? Because it turns out that if you put a monopole in a theta background, you can bind electric charge. And if you do that, we sort of find that you can bind the charge which would correspond to having an angle which is alpha squared times theta. And alpha squared is a real number, which can be, you know, anything small. So this sort of suggests that you could have a tunable magnetoelectric effect in this. No, so this is binding the real charge. How do, so okay, I can go over the Gedanken. So you put a real monopole. The board, should I use the board? So you put a real monopole in a sample. No, it's like CFT here. Yeah, so it's a real monopole. No, it's a real monopole. Oh, it's okay. Well, let me go through it because it's fairly simple. And then this gauge mixing term will create an emergent B field, which looks like you had a monopole of the emergent one. And the theta term for this emergent gauge field, so the theta term for the emergent gauge field makes an E field out of this emergent magnetic field. So you have now an emergent electric field coming out. And via gauge mixing, this alpha term, you generate an E field. So it's as if you were binding an electric charge of the real field. No, it's just a naked monopole with no emergent charge. And the alpha squared comes from these two steps, where you use gauge mixing for the B and E field. So it's like some sort of perturbation theory thing. It's not perturbation theory, but yeah. But I mean, this is work in progress, and I'm still not totally convinced about the quality of this result, so yeah. The other thing that's sort of possible in this effective model is that you can get dynamic excitations. So the emergent gauge field deep down comes from a lattice definition, and it's compact. And this compact gauge field has monopole structures to it. And at the same time, having a theta term and monopoles, so I just mentioned this, was like not really in order. If you have a theta term and monopoles, these monopoles can be shown to bind electric charge. And this was shown by Witten in the context of SUN gauge theory, for example. And also, Rosenberg and Witten and Franz looked at this effect in TIs. So these objects which carry both electric and magnetic charge are called dions. And in this case, it would be emergent dions. And the question is, if these guys are there, what are their effects? So usually, if you want to get out of a deconfined phase as a spin liquid, one way of doing this is to condense your magnetic monopoles. By doing that, you get into a conventional ordered phase. And in this case, what happens if you condense these doubly charged objects? What are the effects on the conventional phases? And also, this brings the question of ionic excitations in the general context and condensed matter, which is something that was fairly not explored. And this is actually fairly it. So I'll just go review what we did. So in the first part, I talked about this microscopic model for the particle iridates, the single band model, which captures a lot of the phases that were found in previous works. So the TI phase, the valsemi-metallic phase, different magnetic orders, some of which were not predicted. And there's still no data on what ordering is present, so this can be useful potentially for future experiments. And we also looked at the robustness of the TI and val phases by looking at how these things evolve and their interactions by using DMFT. And that's like the first analysis of the kind. In the second part, we looked at this quantum field theory description of a topological mod insulator, which is this sort of helical spin liquid which consists of a TI but charge stripped. And we found that the emergent gauge field modifies a lot of the scaling properties and also can give rise to cool properties such as tunable magnetoelectric effect and the ionic excitations. And with this, thank you for your attention. Yeah. Yes. Actually, no, because we, it's actually not even clear to us what will condense, or what is the charge of a dion, actually. It's not clear what the dions will be in this case. So
didn't Pesson and Bale say in their paper that, you know, there's some, like, there's a proposition that the emergent gauge field will, you know, the low energy excitations will be magnetic monopoles of this emergent gauge field.
Yeah.
So are those the dions?
Right, but so the dions, so you have this monopole of the B field, the emergent B field, and this also will bind the gauge electric charge, which is usually theta over 2 pi. So for a TI, this would be 1/2 and times the whatever gauge emergent charge. So that would be the charge of a dion, the electric charge of a dion in this theory. But actually, there's work by Tuft saying that if you have dions which have in a background which theta is equal to pi or almost equal to pi, you could have composite objects condensing instead of the single dions. It's called oblique confinement. So you have bound states of different dions and monopoles that condense. So it's actually not clear what should condense.
What's it called?
Oblique confinement. And also, for example, what is a spin quantum number carried by the dions? This is not clear also. So there's many open questions about actually the actual dions. I think Pesson balance sort of threw it out there, but to actually do this seriously, there's a lot of things to be looked at. Yeah. So we haven't, we tried, but it's hard to get a handle on this, really.
For the magnetic order, you say, you just know it's not featureless, but you just don't know what the feature is.
From experiments?
Yeah.
Well, actually, it's not even clear that, so the muon data, which, so muons have this well-defined precision frequency. This is only for the europium-based compound. So for one compound, they find that the muons at some temperature just process at a well-defined frequency, and this usually means that you have a commensurate order. But I think not everyone was really happy with this data, because the moment they extract from this is really large, way larger than you expect in a spin-orbit coupled compound, because you expect quenching of the moments. And there's also like some interesting spin ice behavior or spin glass behavior. So susceptibility shows us like not divergence, but the field cool and zero field cool show this different behavior. And this is also not clear why this happens. So I mean, from the muon data, I guess one could say that at least this compound, the europium-based compound, is ordered. But the ordering itself is not clear, because you cannot throw neutrons at this thing, because iridium absorbs neutrons. So they cannot do neutron scattering on these compounds. But people are doing like magnetic X-ray, and data actually is coming out pretty soon, because a lot of people want to know what happens in these compounds. So keep your eyes open for it. Yeah.
More questions?
Let's thank Brunel again.